Art Abal is the co-founder of Vana and a specialist in human data systems, a Harvard MPP alum. He previously led global data sourcing at Appen across 8 million contributors in 160 plus countries, helping power major AI products and advising organizations on using behavioral data responsibly. So Art, when you were in high school, did you see yourself working in this domain or did you have other plans? And do you find yourself surprised where you ended up?
I'm very surprised, actually. That's such a good question. So in high school, I was really into performing arts. I was into musical theater. I played music. And I decided that I was, as many high-achieving kids in Australia do, decided that I would just go to university and do the most challenging thing, which ended up being law. So I was a lawyer for as my first career. I went and worked in big law. And I think I realized then and there that there were deeper structural problems associated with how the world works, and I really wanted to dive into it. At that point, there was a lot of movement in tech. There was a lot of the sharing economy revolution. A lot of the Web 2 movement was happening, and I was like, okay, so then how do we, what's the next evolution of this? And I guess I really landed on data as the passion project for me. When I was doing more research work, trying to identify how people were moving through the world. That was really when I kind of hit my strides at Harvard, and I thought, you know, this is something that's really, really important to me and I think really important to society. So yeah, no clue what I was going to do in high school, and definitely wasn't going to be this.
What specifically did you major in college?
I did my Bachelor of Law and Bachelor of Arts, majoring in Studies of Religion and International Relations.
So you're in a very different ecosystem.
Very different world. Very different world. Then went on to do my Master's in Business and Government with a focus on technology. Did my thesis on technology and at Harvard and MIT. So I kind of, you know what, I think that because the system in Australia is a little bit different. You start your professional degree at 17 when you go into university. So you have to choose a professional path straight away, which is why I chose law. And I think I needed to do a lot of growing up before I actually, and knowing the world before I actually like landed on something that worked.
It's like a chicken and egg situation. I think we're kind of just poking at our ambitions and we're growing up as we kind of head forward and then we just figure things out. It's like even AI was all like a pipe dream and then LLMs were just dropped on us out of nowhere. And I find it interesting how it was introduced because if we were to have a discussion maybe 10 years ago or even less, to be honest with you, and we were to say, hey, when your first LLMs come to fruition, how do you imagine it playing out? And we would probably all agree that it'll be in this lab, in this sandbox environment, where you have scientists poking away at it, asking it questions and being really careful that it doesn't slip into the real world. But here we are in the Wild West, and the first real LLM from OpenAI, its MO was throw it into the wild and let's kind of figure things out as we go. I kind of want to pick your brain on that perspective and how do you see the industry playing out?
Yeah, so I kind of was deep. I mean, I've always been interested and fascinated in technology and how it intersects with humans, but I really got my foray into the industry when I was working in data. So I kind of looked at the industry from the perspective of what data was going in and what tools were being built with that data. So when I was at Appen, I was able to see a lot of this stuff. And at the time, the one pattern that I was seeing is that these machines have a thirst for more and more knowledge or more and more information about the world. And part of the reason why it's like throw it out there is the philosophy is if you throw it out there, it starts to learn. But then there are certain things that it can't learn. It needs specific tailored data sets in order to be able to learn. And I think we've almost reached the point now where a lot of the LLMs that you speak of, maybe some of the diffusion models, they've kind of maxed out in terms of how much they can learn by just being thrown out there. And if we want them for very specific use cases and not to just to sound like some, you know, generic management consultant, you kind of need to give it very specific information so that it can learn in that direction. And that's not just language models. That's diffusion models, image to video models I've been playing with. I've been playing with world creation models as well. There's a lacking in them. And that lacking is that they don't have enough knowledge because just throwing them out in the world isn't a perfect way to get that knowledge in for them.
And it's not just about the knowledge, it's about the ability to adjust. There is a conversation circulating that as much as LLMs are getting more advanced, they're not making any progress towards AGI. The CEO of OpenAI kind of brought it up, and you kind of saw this huge explosion forward at first, perhaps because it was from nothing and everything seemed like a drastic change. You're kind of seeing that it's tapering off. I completely agree with you. What do you see the next step being? Because is more data going to be the solution?
I think it's definitely one of the solutions. It's the 80-20 rule, right? So like you can do 20% of the effort and get 80% of the way. And that's what I guess we've been feeling over the last maybe 2 years. I mean, somebody, we were discussing it internally. We were like, if somebody had told me that I would be paying for this little chat bot that I would be writing to write automatic text to me, I'd like 3 years ago, I would have told them they're crazy. But now that's part of our lives. We use LLMs every day. But that 0 to 1, that kind of what I call 80% of the way, we're kind of there. And now we've got this last 20%, which is actually where a lot of the effort goes into. And data is one part of that. We have to make models much more efficient, much more tailored and specific. So there's a lot of algorithmic work that needs to go into there. I think compute efficiency and decentralizing compute could also go into that. So I would say that what we'll probably experience over the next 6 months is this almost slow progress in AI until the next breakthrough comes in, which gets us that little bit more closer to what we want AI to do. And just to pause there for a moment, I think that there is still an open question as to what we want AI to do for us. Not everybody is for this AGI future. And I think as part of reaching that last 80%, we also need to define what that last 80% looks like.
Yeah, I love how you said that 80-20, and I kind of see this process manifest itself in all sorts of ways in the tech domain. Even you can look at internet, for example. Yeah. We technically call it the last mile problem. Yeah. So when you're trying to get packets from one place to another, it's like when it's transoceanic, 80 or 95% of the journey is really quick. But then once it hits your neighborhood, you have so much noise and conversion. That's where it's the hardest to get the actual process done. You're 100% right with AI. Getting the basics done was really easy, but now we're heading to a point where you can almost look at it like diminishing returns, or you're pulling energy from the ground. The lower you dig, the more energy you need to put into the system, the less you get out. There just isn't enough energy. And it's like almost becoming a currency where data and energy are becoming the most valuable things that we focus on. And to broaden the subject for just a second, we do have this three-pronged revolution at our doorstep. We have artificial intelligence, we have the seamless organization of data with blockchain, and then we have quantum computing with quantum supremacy, perhaps a decade away. And each of these domains can greatly advance human life, or perhaps cause great challenges for human life. But synergistically, I think they're going to have this net compounded effect that's going to supersede anything we have ever imagined. And I want to take a bird's eye view for a moment, because I know that you're passionate about blockchain, decentralized structures. I kind of want to get your macro perspective on how do you see all this going?
Wow, that's a big question. I see two kind of polar pathways for a future for us. One, which is very centralized, and I would say would result in great inequities across the way the world currently works. And one, which is very decentralized, that would result in, I think, more creativity in the way the world operates and works. And I think that different constituents of groups of people will land on different sides of that in terms of where they want the future to go. I think we're making critical choices today that could determine which one we actually choose. I don't necessarily think there is a better or worse version of it. It's just a different nature of society. So I love watching futuristic sci-fi. I love seeing like this kind of futuristic dystopia. I think that the decisions that we're making in 2016 will impact the dystopic or utopic future that we create over the next 5 to 10 years. And those critical decisions for me are who controls those inputs, those factors of production that you were talking about. So compute, data, energy, creativity, innovation, who has the right to exercise those factors of productivity. We're determining that today, and we should be paying very close attention to how that's being determined, both at the legislative and policy level and at the technology level and in the private markets.
Yeah, that's a great answer. Now we're zooming a little more in here. Tell me about Vanna and what is it exactly that you're trying to solve?
Yeah, so it's definitely that that data as a critical input for these futuristic systems. So the basic premise here is that private personal data is incredibly valuable, even more so now that these AI systems have reached what we call the data wall. The public data is exhausted for them. And so in order to be able to train for specific use cases or to be able to hit these edge cases, they need richer data. And for certain use cases, they need rich private data. So an example of that would be AI knows how relationships are conducted in public, but it doesn't really know how relationships are conducted in private. So if you're trying to get coaching or speak to an AI in a relationship context, it's just not going to really give you that great of an experience. But it can't get that data because that data isn't public. It's your data. And so I think this is where Vanna comes in and says the choice as to whether or not AI should have that data should be your choice because it's your data. There are other ways in which to get this data. I know it. I come from that world, which is very much on that data brokerage side of things where you're completely out of that equation. But I want to reimagine a future in which you actually have skin in the game and you control the data that goes into these technologies. And you also control the value that you're receiving from the value that you're creating. So every day you're creating data points, every day you're creating a digital footprint. Vanna lets you take that and move it around so that you can get maximum value from that, whether that value is cash value, whether that value is participation in a community, whether that value is participation in an app or an optimized experience. You can think about Vanna as the permissioning layer that allows you to take your data back and use it however you want.
Interesting. And what specific areas where if you can see a breakthrough, would that greatly enhance your ability to function as a company?
Huge breakthrough is actually societal and legislative and policy change. It's not technology. The technology is there. Decentralized technology is built for this. One of the most well-known data regimes is the GDPR. The GDPR applies to folks in Europe. When you request your data through a GDPR request, a company has 30 days in which to give you your data. It's your data. Everybody knows that companies can just give it to you within milliseconds. So why does it take 30 days? It's because policy is back in the 90s, back in the 2000s. Yeah. And they really stymie progress because they're not fit for today's purpose, especially with AI rapidly advancing. Yeah. And so you'll find that a lot of these large tech companies that have your data will use these regulatory protections to actually keep you away from having access to your data. We've seen a lot of strong movement. So we partnered with Project Liberty last year, and they managed to support changes in laws in the state of Utah to require social media companies to put data on protocols for data portability, which is the ability to move your data around. So we're seeing some of this regulatory movement. We've also advised members of the European Parliament on proposed changes to GDPR. So I think that the tailwinds will come. It will just be something to look out for over the next year or two. And I just hope that they'll be fast enough.
Yeah, well said. And it's always important to dig one step deeper. Why is it so difficult to make change at a governmental level? One perspective could be politicians, and I guess this is not a slight against politicians specifically and more broadly human nature, is to really focus on the problems of today. And with respect to politicians, it's within their term. And a lot of these problems, you can kick the can down the road. You want to worry about being favorable by your audience, getting elected on the next round. And that's the problem where the bigger picture stuff really don't move very quickly.
I think that that's part of the problem for sure. So I used to work in politics. I've worked for politicians here in Australia, and I obviously studied at the Kennedy School in the US. I think part of it is just a disconnect between what politicians know and what you need to know to be a good politician and what you need to know to govern an AI and technology-driven world. There's a massive divide between those two things.
They're not scientists. They're not doctors. And you're forced to like take these complex esoteric topics and simplify them in a 20-minute presentation. And it doesn't go anywhere. Yeah.
No, it's not just a mismatch of the knowledge that they're able that they absorb, but it's a mismatch of skill sets. Because the skills that make you a good architect of a technology-driven system are not necessarily the skills that make you a good politician or policymaker. So we need to find a way to bridge those skill gaps. And that's why we do a lot of these private-public partnerships where it's like, it's okay, we all have skill gaps. Like, I'm not going to be able to move laws and you're not going to be able to build a protocol, but we can work together to do it. And I think that's where bridging political divides amongst the private and public sector is actually critical for this future that we need to create.
I'm curious to know about how private data is conventionally used as opposed to your model, where conventional, it's almost like this backdoor and like little caveats in the terms of use. And strangely, that's where a lot of the business models for companies come from. It's from leveraging your data, as opposed to where you're opening the door to that and you're leveraging that correctly. Talk about that difference.
So I'm assuming you're not monetizing your data, Michael. You haven't sold your data to anyone yourself. You haven't. Have you earned any money?
Certainly not. No, but it is being sold.
Exactly. And so that is probably the starting point for how the current system works. So your data is being bought and sold today without you participating in that. It's subpar for you as the creator of the data because you're not getting economic you're not getting economic value. You're not participating in the economic system. But what few people know is it's actually subpar for the consumer of that data because they get a very sanitized set of your data. They don't get the richness of who you are because of regulatory and other issues. And I've spoken to folks on both sides. Like I know people who contribute their data and I know machine learning engineers that are like, this is ridiculous. Like I can't build my model based on these assumptions and predictions. I would actually like to know who this person is. At the same time, there are people who actually want to contribute their data to certain things. On Vana, we have these data collectives, and one of them, for example, is the Cancer DAO. And those guys are trying to bring together a lot of medical research around cancer. And they want to bring personal data in because they want to identify the non-typical determinants of cancer. They can't do that in the current data landscape by giving that to a company because they wouldn't be able to. So the old system exists in a way that requires brokers and folks who want to sell their data, want to buy data, to go through brokerages to sanitize that data in order to consume it. This way is more like a direct-to-consumer approach to data. If you as a machine learning engineer want to access a user's data, you just ask them. Like, I don't understand why we have a system in which a user can't be asked for their data. If they want to give it to them, they can give it to them. Like, that's just, it seems like, the analogy I would draw is like a banking system where you need some sort of broker every time you want to withdraw cash from an ATM.
Yeah. But it's also like now you have a more authentic model for retrieving data, but you have a traumatized population who's become so distrustful and cynical towards the motivation of companies. That's an example of where the technology is there, but it's this social and regulatory barriers that impede you from just expressing your technology in its best way possible.
I like the word distrustful because I think that that has come about because of these business models where we haven't fully disclose to a user what they're doing. And users have, it's bred distrust in that way. I think that's why it requires both policy and societal and business change to make it work. Because people are wising up to the fact that their data has been, it's not like, oh, my data is being stolen today. It's like my data has been stolen for the last 15 years that I've used Facebook.
Right.
That's really frustrating for me. And that's where we're starting from.
Right. And every company starts up with great goals and ambitions, and then they become so big and then they become the thing they're fighting. And we expect that to be part of the process. If you can't get them to comply, you just beat them, as they say. And I guess this would be a good segue into the conversation of decentralized structures. We have for so long conformed to a system that requires a central authority to make decisions, and we're slowly moving away from that. And if you can tell us more about what that is and how that can benefit all of us.
Yeah, so the interesting thing about your data is that when you transact with it, so when you create data on a platform, you actually don't lose rights to the data that you create. You grant them a license to use your data. And the amazing thing about data is that you can always reclaim those rights. So you can always get your data back from these platforms because you're the one who created it. It's your data. Where decentralization helps is because you're just getting your data, you can use that data in amongst collectives to create value with them. And that's where decentralization is incredibly powerful. You remove the need for a central entity to broker and bring together this data. You as an individual can do it yourself. And I think that that's super important for a system. When Anna, my co-founder, and I were thinking about Barna, we didn't want to recreate another Google. We don't want to create another centralized repository for everyone's data. We want to create the highway for you as a user to, first of all, understand your data's value and then yield value from that data itself.
Imagine this is all done right. And we take a time machine 10 years from now, and we live in a utopian society where no one is fearful of sharing their data. And we have maximized the possibilities for growth with this model. How do you see all this playing out?
Yeah, I actually have this futuristic vision. I run my data on my own personal server at home. So whenever I use a social platform, I try to get all of my data into my personal server. Tim Berners-Lee had this idea of the internet initially, where it was that everyone would carry a little wallet around with them, and it would store all of their, you know, all of their important things. And then cloud came along and made that thing kind of not as needed anymore. I see this future in which we come back to it because we realize how valuable these digital assets are, you know, kind of like we realize how valuable our ledgers are. Now we realize how valuable our data is. And I can imagine a future in which we all have data ledgers and then we carry them around and it has data and compute because we use it in AI. And that we start to think about these intangible assets as just as valuable as a home or a car or any physical asset. That is at the individual level. At the societal level and at the technology level, I would like to see people be more aware and participate more in the creation of technology. Like there's this one application that's being built on Varna that combines your health tracker data with your Google Meet data to work out which meetings on your calendar cause you the greatest anxiety. I would love to say that I am part of that community that's built that, and that for that technology to have, you know, me in it, I'd be very proud of. So I would like to see a future in which technology is co-created with the data providers and the technologists, and where each of us as individuals truly value our data in a tangible way.
Yeah, you said something really interesting. In the 70s, when they were serial killers, all these precincts and all these different states didn't want to share information because they wanted to be the one who catched the serial killer. And often in retrospect, you look back at these cases and there's an extreme amount of incompetence because just a basic level of communication and cooperation, these problems could have been exponentially easier to solve, thus saving so many more lives. And it looks the same with technology now. We're at a point where there's so much data across these different companies. If there's some sort of protocols or systems for better communication, the net positive is for everyone. All companies can do more with their business models if only they can get like repository of data where they can share effectively. But that comes with this whole, all its concerns as well. But yeah, if done right, of course, this world can be a much better place. And something really interesting.
Thank you.
Yeah. So Art, how can people get in touch with you?
You can follow me on X, ArtyArt88, or follow Varna on X, @Varna. Feel free to reach out. At some crypto events, I'll be at Consensus next week if folks are going to be there. But yeah, reach out to me. And I would love to jam with anybody who's building anything that they want more data for, that they're like, hey, if I just had access to users, I mean, this amazing builder is building this protocol that allows you to take your ChatGPT memories across to all of your LLMs so that you never have to give it context again. Anybody has ideas like that, throw them my way. Because it's really frustrating having to put context in.
Because it's like abstraction builds on abstraction and you have none of that. You have one text area to throw all your stuff in there.
And if you actually go into some of these LLMs now because of the data regulation I think they're subject to, they can't give you personal information about yourself even if you've given it to them. They won't actually serve you that. So they won't give you your passport details or your address. And I'm like, if I want to create an agent of myself, I don't want to have to continue to put in my credit card details, my passport details, right. But at the same time, I don't want a central entity to control this. That's where a protocol like Varna comes in, where it's like, no, I control it and I permission it and run my own compute and allow my agent to do things that I want it to do.
Good. That's a very good way of putting it. That hits directly at the core of what you're doing and resonates with someone like me who's on the outside listening. That's great.
Thank you. Yeah, I feel like a lot of people are having this problem right now because LLMs are just touching everything that we do. And it's like, you know, you almost feel like it could do more, but it's not doing it for you. And you just,
right.
I don't know how many fights you've had with ChatGPT in the last year.
Yeah, because you'd see it deploy a higher level of aptitude and common sense in certain contexts. And then in other contexts, you see it seriously fail.
Yep.
And you know it's not a capability issue. It's more of a context or data access issue.
There's like no meeting of the minds. There's no context. So we're working with a bunch of builders who are building these cool new applications on Vana's data portability layer. So if you're interested in, if any of your listeners are interested in building these types of applications that consume data or allow data to be useful, I'm very interested to hear from you.
Art, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Michael. That was enjoyable.